science, technology, society, our lives, philosophy, and religion. This is Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. The dream of exploration and understanding the stars above us has always been fundamental throughout the history of humankind. Now, imagine that we no longer have to settle for just seeing the stars from a distance. Instead, imagine being able to be among them through probes, cameras, and instruments. Imagine the ability to send out thousands of probes to the stars and have them arrive only decades later. This may no longer be just a dream, for a radical new idea of space exploration has been proposed, an idea to attach tiny space probes to sails and have them be accelerated to relativistic speeds via lasers. This would open up a new era of exploration for humankind. This vision has recently been funded by the Breakthrough Foundation. Today, we are joined by Dr. Philip Lubin, a professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He and his group have been developing this idea. Thank you for joining us today, Philip.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to speak to you again, Elizabeth.
The nearest star to our sun is Alpha Centauri. Using traditional methods, how long would it take to get there?
Well, Alpha Centauri is about 4 light years away, and 4 light years is a very long ways away compared to the spacecraft that we currently have capabilities on with normal propulsion. So, for example, the Voyager spacecraft, it would take almost 100,000 years to get to Alpha Centauri. You know, with ion engines, we could do a bit better, and there are ways with our conventional propulsion systems to speed up the process a little bit, but not by the many orders of magnitude that we would like to see. So the core technologies that we have that got us to the moon and will get us to Mars will not get us to the stars in any reasonable timescale. It simply is not feasible. If we want to go to the stars, even the nearest stars besides our sun, we have to rethink the process completely or abandon the idea of going.
Yeah. So if we really want to become an interstellar civilization, we'll need something a little different than these traditional methods that you just discussed for propulsion. And so you and your group, you're discussing a new method to travel among the stars. Could you talk a little bit about this new method that you're researching?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is a way to get to relativistic speeds that's practical, that's reality-based rather than, insert miracle or imaginary-based. And so we're not using wormholes or some sort of exotic propulsion that we just can't see our way to the future. So we're going to attempt to put a spacecraft onto a wafer. In our case, the wafer will be roughly 10 centimeters on a side. Whether round or square doesn't really matter at the moment, but roughly 10 centimeters, which is about 4 inches. Now, it could be larger than that. It could be smaller than that.
Okay. So how much bigger can these probes be?
They can be any size. However, the smaller the probe, the less power in general it has, the less capability it has, but the faster it goes. So there's a trade-off between mass and capability. What we've been focusing on is pushing to what we think is an extreme, which I'm sure 50 years from now will not be an extreme at all, but we're pushing towards putting essentially all the salient elements of a spacecraft onto a wafer. If we produce a spacecraft that's about a gram, which is not a lot of mass, but certainly enough for a wafer, you can achieve a speed of greater than 20% the speed of light. If you increase the mass up to 10 kilograms, which is 10,000 times the mass of a 1 gram wafer scale spacecraft, 10 kilograms is roughly 2 gallons of milk, roughly. That spacecraft with the same drive system that would drive a 1 gram spacecraft to 20% speed of light would drive a 10 kilogram spacecraft to 1/10 that speed, not 1/10,000, 1/10 that speed. So at 20% speed of light, we'd get to Alpha Centauri, which is 4 light years away in 20 years, which is one of our stated goals.
This is pretty exciting then, that you'll actually be able to send probes among the stars in a generation or two.
And that's the goal, is to, within a You know, we try to leave it reasonable, so you know, within a generation, be able to have the first launches that are relativistic and can then get to the nearest stars, and you know, of order 20 years or so. So yeah, it is very exciting.
Okay, so these probes don't actually act like the traditional rockets, which carry their own propellant with them, but rather these probes will be accelerated by a laser on the ground. How much energy would this laser need, and how would this laser work exactly to send the probes on their way?
Yeah, great question. We're not going anywhere unless we develop this technology, and this being these very high-power laser arrays. In our case, it's not a single laser, but it's an array of lasers. And it'd be good for the audience to understand that we're not talking about sending one probe out to the stars. We're talking about sending thousands to, you know, possibly literally millions to the stars. It's not really a laser in the normal sense, but is rather a light amplifier, or it amplifies laser light coming in, and then what comes out is higher power. In the laser array, we take many laser amplifiers, put them in parallel, if you will, and spread out the optical elements, which is also key, because we need large area to get small spot at large distances, or confine the energy emitted to a small enough spot to push on the spacecraft at large distances. And then we synchronize them together, we phase them, which is just a fancy term for synchronize them, and then we synthesize a beam, which looks like it came from one very large laser, but really what it does is come from a very large number of very modest laser amplifiers, which then through light carrying energy momentum pushes against the spacecraft on using a reflector, and that pushes the spacecraft forward. So in a sense, it's like a spacecraft with no propellant on board. It only takes a few minutes to get up to about 20% speed of light with the very lightest or lowest mass spacecraft we're talking about.
Would these lasers accelerate these probes directly away from the Earth, or would they work in more traditional sense where the probe is orbiting the Earth and the laser gives it a kick every time it goes over, so it goes up in higher and higher orbits until it eventually leaves the gravitational pull of the Earth?
Yeah, it's a great question. On our website is a nice animation that shows the latter of what you just discussed, namely that you are, you know, kicking it as it goes around, and just like on a swing, you know, you push it and then you wait for it to come back to you and push it again, and then eventually you get a very large motion. But that's not what we're doing for the relativistic spacecraft. The relativistic spacecraft are pushed at enormous accelerations, well more than 10,000 Gs. And they are just shot out, sort of like a, you know, a cannon or a, you know, a bullet. In a few minutes, it's gone. And then, essentially, you could launch the next one, which is why I say you can launch an armada.
All right. So these lasers must be extremely powerful. Is there an analogy for how much power that they have?
Yes. So the analogy that I like to use is that the space shuttle or the proton launcher or the Dragon, when it lifts off, normally the thrust is given in the number of newtons of force or pounds of force, depending on, you know, which side of the pond you live on. But you can also convert that to a power, and that's not how they're quoted normally, but it's instructive for us. So when you compute the power of the previous space shuttle or the upcoming SLS, it's about 50 gigawatts coming off the launch pad. It turns out the laser has essentially the same power, about 50 to 100 gigawatts, just in photons rather than in chemistry. But to put that in perspective, the United States has a generating capacity of about 1,000 gigawatts or a terawatt. So 100 gigawatts of power is a lot of power, you know, compared to what we're used to. So for reasons of economy, while we could launch every few minutes, which has been a tantalizing thing to ponder, we could launch a new probe every couple minutes and then launch hundreds per day, you know, 50,000 or more per year, which would be just an amazing thing to think about. We're not planning to do that in the Breakthrough Foundation approach. We're planning to trickle charge up to enough energy to fire the laser array for a couple minutes, that's required, and then do that about once every day or a couple days. And so the power requirements, the average power requirements, are modest. So we're not planning to dim the lights, you know, across the entire country.
With a laser this powerful, when the laser itself actually hits the probe in order to accelerate it, do you have to worry about heat dissipation on the probe so that it isn't destroyed by the heat from the laser?
Yeah, that much power is quite capable of vaporizing the probe rather quickly. And so you have to handle the reflection and absorption at the reflector. So there's really two parts to the spacecraft, two essential parts. One is the spacecraft itself, if you want to think of the wafer, and the other is a reflector, which faces the laser. So the wafer, the spacecraft, is on the opposite side of the laser for obvious reasons, so you don't vaporize it. And there's a reflector, and the reflector, even the best mirrors that we currently produce in terms of astronomical telescopes or even very high quality laser, high power laser mirrors in general are not good enough. They absorb too much, and they themselves would be either severely damaged or the temperatures would rise dramatically. We may get away with that. I'm still looking at that. But another approach which will definitely work is to make a mirror out of all dielectric. So imagine a piece of glass which has additional dielectric layers on the front, additional types of glasses, if you will, or layers on the front, no metals. And that then reflects a significant portion of the light, but that light which goes through the reflector is hardly absorbed at all. It's a hard problem, actually. The sail is a major technological development.
The sail only absorbs certain wavelengths, but as the sail accelerates, the wavelength that it actually observes from the laser on the ground will get longer and longer. Do you actually have to take into account these effects?
Yeah, that's a great question. That really is a function of how we design the reflectivity properties of the mirror or the reflector. And normally the best reflectivity is done by very carefully tuning the reflector for a specific wavelength. Now, we will be changing the wavelength that the spacecraft sees because it's moving away from us. There'll be a Doppler shift. Well, since we're going at 20% speed light, hopefully, we'll be changing the wavelength it sees by about 20%. So it will see a longer wavelength. And that means that we need to have a reflectivity which will work over about a 20% bandwidth. And that's not actually terrible. It's a little bit larger than I would like, but it's not terrible. I think we will be able to design an appropriate reflectivity. What's key is that you not absorb too much.
So let's talk a little bit about the actual journey of this probe now. Let's say it's heading towards Alpha Centauri at 20% the speed of light. Is there a significant risk that this little probe would crash into something along the way, even like an asteroid or even like a little fleck of dust? And would that cause a lot of harm to this probe?
Yeah, that's another great question. You know, if we hit an asteroid of the type that you're thinking about, you know, the game's over for the spacecraft, at least. The amount of energy in the kinetic energy in the wafer going at 20% speed of light, even though it's a very low mass, you know, order of gram, is quite significant. It's about a kiloton equivalent, so it's like a small tactical nuclear weapon in terms of equivalent energy. So it's not going to fracture a large asteroid. You know, if it's a small asteroid, it could blow it apart. So, yeah, if you hit a rock, you know, of the kind that you're thinking about, it's all over for the spacecraft. Now, in interplanetary space between planets and in interstellar space, there are tiny things. So the chances of hitting an asteroid are really small. Yes, there are a lot of asteroids out there, but there's a lot more space than there are asteroids. So I'm not particularly worried about that. And also keep in mind, we're sending out huge numbers of these probes. So if we lose some on the way. That's to be expected. However, the more interesting problem is the amount of small things, such as dust grains in interstellar space. We don't know as much as we'd like to about the distribution of dust grains in interstellar space, say between here and Alpha Centauri. It's rather complex. Our best guess at this point is that if you imagine in your mind a wafer and kind of think of a pancake or a frisbee, or a plate, and think of the plate going edge on towards the stars. In that case, I think you get about roughly 400 dust grain hits that are 1 micron dust grains or larger. So the question is, what does a hit do? Well, if it's a large dust grain, like if we hit a millimeter dust grain, it's probably just going to destroy the wafer. It might just punch a hole through it. It doesn't look like this is a showstopper at all. So you could have many redundant systems. You could imagine having tens or hundreds or even thousands of redundant systems. So if one gets punched through by a dust grain and gets destroyed, it has a smart enough system to reconfigure itself.
Okay. These probes might actually have a very interesting problem that we haven't had to deal with before. And basically, these cameras would be traveling at relativistic speeds. And you mentioned that the probe would be traveling edge-on, so maybe this wouldn't be a problem. But I would imagine that if you got to a location and then you start taking pictures with this camera, the same light from the star or planet or whatever it's trying to take a picture of might be either shifted into the infrared or the ultraviolet because this probe is traveling so fast. So is that something you have to take into account, or are there any other problems that this relativistic camera might have to deal with?
There are relativistic effects, and they're quite interesting. So there are interesting rotation effects. I think you have to think about this in a way which is not always intuitive. Because light travels at a finite speed, when you take a picture of something, you're taking a picture of something that was in the past, because light had to leave the object to get to you. And when you kind of ponder the full meaning of that, you realize that when you take a picture of an object and you're moving relatively rapidly, that the object is effectively sort of rotated in your field of view, and it's also color shifted due to Doppler effects. But that's okay. We can deal with that, and we could sort of deconvolve it as well. I'm not too worried about that. If we were traveling at extremely high speeds, that would be a different case, but we're not. We're traveling 20% speed light. The relativistic correction is actually relatively small. But it is there. It's true.
Okay. So another thing that I was curious about. So let's talk about the energy that these probes will have to carry with them. How will these tiny probes communicate back with Earth once they reach their destination?
So there's on board the spacecraft is a laser communication system, which is powered by a radioisotope battery. There's a little bit of radioactive material on board, which produces heat due to the radioactive decay. That heat then is converted into electricity through essentially thermoelectric effect generators, and then you get some electricity out of it. But they don't provide very much power, given the amount of mass that we have available. But it looks like it's sufficient to power us during the cruise phase. Once we get to the star of interest, hopefully we'll get close enough that we can use photovoltaics on board to provide even more power, which will then increase the amount of bandwidth we have to send data back to the Earth. And this is a very tricky part of the whole program, is how do you get the data back from such a long distance? And laser communication is really the only way that I know of how to do this.
So basically, the laser array that you use to originally accelerate these probes to relativistic speeds, you can actually use later as a giant telescope to communicate with these tiny probes once they reach their destination.
That's correct.
Is there a plan to send these probes to something closer, say like Pluto or Neptune, before we start sending it across interstellar space?
Absolutely. So on the roadmap is a number of milestones before we ever get to the relativistic case. Milestones technologically, milestones for the lasers, the laser array, the spacecraft, the reflector. You know, there's a whole research and development program. It's not going to be trivial at all. It's a very complex system. The obvious targets in our solar system are many, and the fact that you could conceivably start sending these probes out in large numbers opens up a number of tantalizing possibilities, particularly when we get to the point where we can reach high speeds. You know, we could much more easily get to, you know, the distance of Pluto instead of waiting many decades. We could get out there, you know, in a matter of, you know, weeks or so. I mean, you can imagine a swarm of these wafers being ejected from a quote regular, you know, spacecraft that we send to, you know, Europa or Titan or wherever you choose, and these probes just get, you know, just dispersed. And there's such low mass, you could, you know, carry literally, you know, 1,000 of them in a kilogram. You know, you just imagine what you could do.
So, sort of a personal question: let's say you can send these probes anywhere in the universe. What destinations are you most looking forward to visiting via these probes?
I see this as an enabling capability. So just as, you know, the ability to put a sail on a ship, you know, enabled a vastly different way of exploration from paddling a ship or a canoe. You know, once you realize that you could use the wind to take you around the world, that opened up a whole realm of exploration, which had been much harder to do with simple paddling. And I think the situation is similar here. Once we open up the capability to sail on the wind of lasers, if you will, we open up a whole set of explorations that is just not possible now. We're going to really embark and change the way in which things evolve. It will be a difficult and complex path, but the rewards for doing this are, you know, truly enormous and will benefit everybody. I'm quite likely will not live to see the first launches to interstellar targets, but the capabilities that come from this, I hope to be at least alive long enough to see the beginning fruits of that and push it along far enough to get to the point where we can, you know, see it through to the next generation. But it will be left to the generation of your podcast listeners, you know, to pick up and carry forth.
Right. So if our listeners want to learn a little more, where could they go to see your website or see this roadmap that you discussed?
What I would suggest is going to our website, which is www.deepspace, just as it sounds, .ucsb.edu. And, you know, just kind of look at it and then let's talk, you know, as a community. I mean, begin a discussion. I really want to raise awareness, get people excited. I love getting emails from people. I've gotten so many beautiful emails from children. You know, I'm 9-year-olds who want to raise money from their, you know, PTA and start a candy sale, literally, you know, to raise money to do this. It's amazing. You know, you really touch a chord in people and start talking about exploring in these wonderful areas. And I really encourage people to start a dialogue, because this is, you know, this does not belong to me. This belongs to all of you, and you will be the ones that will see the fruits of this, and the younger ones amongst you will be the ones that take this up.
Right. Well, it certainly captured my imagination, and I imagine a lot of people are very excited about this and all the implications that can come along from it. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on today.
Great. Well, it was wonderful talking to you, and I hope that we can have additional conversations down the road and keep you posted on what we're doing.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcast. If you like us, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.